This podcast was brought to you by Business Radio, powered by Wharton, originally airing on Sirius XM.
Welcome to our Behind the Markets podcast. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz. Alongside Wharton Frank Professor Jeremy Siegel, we tackle the latest market trends every week on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School, Sirius XM, Channel 132. Welcome to Behind the Markets here on Business Radio, powered by the Wharton School. I'm your host, Jeremy Schwartz, Global CIO at WisdomTree. My co-host is Wharton Finance Professor Jeremy Siegel, who is also a senior economist to WisdomTree. I should note I'm a registered representative of Foresight Fund Services, and our discussion is not tied to the offers of any investment products. We're going to have a very interesting discussion. We're going to be talking about the commercial mortgage-backed securities or commercial mortgage market with Tom Capasse, of the CEO of Ready Capital. It's going to be a very interesting look at where interest rates are moving. What did it think about it? How do you think about real estate? So we have a deep dive with Tom about his firm and what's going on there. But Professor, a lot of data on the table. We're going to kick off with you as normal, a view of interest rates, inflation, the markets. How are you looking at all the latest headlines?
Okay, so of course we're all gearing up to understanding what's going to happen next Wednesday, the FOMC meeting. We could start by saying that the CPI and PPI were slightly on the disappointing side, came in on the firm side. Nothing extraordinary, but certainly will reinforce the views of the hawks on the FOMC committee, who are more resistant to lowering the interest rates. And I'll talk a little bit about what I think is actually going to happen. The truth is, and I think this is, we said this a month ago when the January report came out. If you read the BLS description of the data, there's a sentence in there, that core year over year inflation came in, at 3.8%. That was 1/10 above expectations, and then follows immediately. And 2/3 of the year-over-year increase was due to increase in the shelter component. Now, we have talked so many times, about how distorted the shelter component is of the consumer price index, lagged and much higher than it is. The data that comes out of apartment list on rental rates is actually negative 1% year over year. The data that comes out of Zillow, which is a little bit lagged from apartment list, I think is up 2.5% year over year. But of course, they get a 6% because of their super lagged index. If you put in current rental data for 41% of the core, which it is, 41% of the core is shelter, you basically are down below 2% on a year-over-year basis. So I am not, at all concerned about that inflation. That being said, let's be honest with the data. The sensitive commodity prices have stopped going down. They're not really going up. Yes, oil is a bit on the firm side, but excluding oil, they're going sideways. The big downturn that existed over the last almost 2 years, and let's say the Bloomberg Commodity Index, is basically now flattened out, bottomed, not going up, but showing a bottom. Some of the core goods suddenly, instead of going down a month over month, are beginning to show some firmness in there. Again, I'm not alarmed about it, but it does show that there isn't a big squeeze going on overall liquidity that we see in the market. Now, on the real side, the February retail sales were somewhat disappointing. We did have a terrible January because of weather. There was a bounce back, but not quite as high. From what I see, most services trim their report of GDP estimates of the first quarter down by about 0.4%. I believe that Atlanta GDP is now in the low twos. I think JP Morgan and maybe Goldman Sachs are in the high ones. So let's say two. Now, two for the first quarter. And again, we've got a lot of data going in. The first quarter, as you know, isn't even over. But it's not terrible at all. It's not the three plus that we got in the fourth quarter of 2023, but it's certainly it's higher than the estimates that the Fed produced last December in terms of what it is. So it's a decent level, and we've got more data coming in. Now, let's talk about next Wednesday. Of course, there will be no change. But what will be the most interesting thing will be the dot plot. Now, it is my estimation that the dot plot will be considerably more hawkish than the dot plot that came out last December, which indicated three cuts in the Fed funds rate by the end of the year. In fact, it is my estimate that the median very well might move to two cuts from three cuts. And I wouldn't be surprised that if you count the dots of less than two cuts, they might exceed those that the dots that exceed two cuts. I do see, and the reason is very simply, first of all, that inflation on their measured statistics has been sticky. And the real economy, and this is the most important thing, has been holding out extremely well. Again, a low reading, besides the retail sales, another low reading on unemployment claims. Other real data is fine. We're not seeing, you know, the Hairburgers of a big downturn. If any only data, by the way, that they're getting between now and the meeting is going to be housing starts. We'll see how that is, but housing starts is very lagged. That'll be a February figure. We should mention, by the way, with the firming up of the bond rates as a result of these higher than expected CPI and PPI numbers, that the mortgage rate, the no point 30-year mortgage rate, has moved to 7.1%, actually 7.15, I think, yesterday. So, you know, those will begin to, you know, maybe do some suppression on the housing price front. And maybe on the housing activity front. But the truth is that the economy is still rolling along at not too rapid a rate and showing no obvious signs of weakness. And this will embolden those that are resistant to the cut. Again, we talked about last week, the unemployment rate reached 3.9. Yeah, that's a two-year high. I think 4% is something that will grab headlines if the March report comes in on that. We won't know for, you know, 2 weeks on that. But nonetheless, at this point, there's very little pressure. Now, what does the Fed funds say? If you look at the December or January Fed funds, which represents Fed funds in the month of December, it is predicting exactly. Well, now, I should not use the word predicting. It is indicating three cuts from current rate. As we've discussed many times on this show, the Fed funds is not an unbiased estimate of what the participants in the market expect the Fed funds rate to be. It is a downward bias number. The reason is because it's a negative beta asset, and I won't go into that now. My estimate is about 125 basis point cut is built in as a bias downward on the December end of year Fed funds, which would be the January Fed funds contract. That means that really the three that we see represents two on expectation, which is what I said I expect them. Now, the market not understanding these biases very well might on Wednesday at 2 o'clock when this news comes out, 2 p.m. on Wednesday, might say, oh, my God. Look at this. They're pulling back. You could see a sharp reaction in the markets then, depending on how expectations are. But the truth of the matter is the market is really only expecting about two. It was expecting three, actually 3.5 at one point. But the strength of the data and the firmness of the reported CPI clearly is going to push down the number of cuts that the FOMC members are going to indicate in their dot plot.
So the market rotation we're seeing at the end of this week, so it's part of it, you got rates moving higher, the 10-year back to 430. Is that pressuring the NASDAQ, you think? Is it more the earnings?
A little bit. Yeah, we're saying, oh, you know, there was a little bit of a blow off on NVIDIA, though it's holding up well. Usually those one-day reversals are not the end. They're the, you know, that's just a little head fake on the road. I still think momentum will return to those stocks. But with the higher yields and, you know, the risks of what the FOMC going to do, et cetera, there's a little bit of a pause built in. We also get a widening. I mean, energy has done very well, and we've had firmness in those oil prices. So we do have some still good movements towards the so-called value stocks and the small stocks, and that's good in broadening out. I would also like to mention that, you know, people say the Mag 7 is turned into the Mag 6 because Tesla has fallen from grace. I think it's a good sign that people don't put everything into one category. I mean, at the same time that Tesla has almost halved in price over the last, what, 6-9 months, you know, NVIDIA is up 200%. It shows you there's still people are distinguishing between those companies that really are delivering and those companies which are not. That's a good sign, I think, that, you know, that rationality is in the market, although at any time, you know, the bubble going into 2000, a bubble could be beginning. I'm not calling it. I'm just saying we could be at such an early stage, and we have to be on alert for that.
Tom, we're going to spend a lot of time with you on what's happening in your segment of the commercial real estate and your view on the economy, interest rates, and real estate. Anybody, anything you want to jump in to comment to the professor or questions before we have him sign off?
No, I appreciate the insight because the Fed got its way with everybody's talking soft landing, but we've had a hard landing, and we're just figuring out how to pick ourselves off the pavement right at this point in the commercial real estate market.
Yeah, that's been the one market that's really suffered. I don't know if every, you know, bank has cleared out there. I mean, we saw the New York Community Bank, which is supposed to have written it down. It didn't seem to have written it down. And, you know, is that there? And I, again, don't think this is going to be systemic. I think there's going to be a lot of mergers in the small bank side as a result of consolidation of the portfolios. There's a lot of people that are going to pick over a lot of, you know, those in the know and really that can distinguish, you know, these are, you know, they often said Sam Zell passed away a few years ago, was the grave dancer on real estate, right? I mean, he was the one who looked at a disaster and picked up and became wealthy doing that. Those in the know which credits to pick up. So I agree.
Well, Professor, thanks for giving us some comments to start the show. We'll talk to you again next week.
Yeah, absolutely. Bye.
All right. We're going to continue our conversation with Tom Capasse, who's the CEO, CIO of Ready Capital. So, Tom, maybe you could give our listeners a little bit about Ready Capital, what you, for people who don't know anything about your business, talk a bit about the structure, what you guys focus on, and your background there.
Yeah, no, I appreciate that, Jeremy. So Ready Capital is the fourth largest commercial mortgage REIT. There's about 20 commercial mortgage REITs. We're the fourth largest based on equity, the three largest being Starwood, Blackstone, and Arbor, a multifamily lender. Our niche is really focused on two things. One is our business is we're the largest non-bank lender for the lower middle market commercial real estate debt market with a focus on multifamily bridge transitional loans that are once a sponsor will buy a property, convert it from Garden B to A-, and then get a mortgage from the government agencies, Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac. We have a number of those licenses or access to them. So we're really providing bridge financing for sponsors in the lower middle market, which we define as $5 million to $50 million, to buy these smaller apartments in good markets and upgrade them and convert them to a higher earning assets, and with stabilization and takeout in the Fannie Mae, Freddie Mac multifamily market. It's a big market. You know, Fannie Freddie together will do about $150 billion a year of lending. The other side of what we do is we tackle the so-called owner-occupied market as one of a dozen non-bank SBA 7A lenders, the Small Business Administration. And this provides loans, been around since the 60s, and provides government-guaranteed loans up to 75% for a $5 million cap to businesses, small businesses. We tend to focus on the real estate side because we're a REIT. And so that's the other side of what we do. And we're the fourth largest, actually, in the United States in that segment, overtaking Wells Fargo in the last year or two. So those are our two businesses. And the main business provides, most of our shareholder base, because REITs offer very significant dividend premiums to other fixed income investments, most of our shareholder base is ETFs and retail. So the core business is the net interest margin on the capital invested in the capital heavy commercial real estate transitional multifamily business. And the other side of what we do is the SBA business is very profitable, and you retain very little risk on these loans. Sell them in the secondary market, it's 10 point profit. So that's our gain on sale business. So it's a unique mix targeting a niche. And basically our competition is Jeremy, we touched on regional and community banks. That's who our competition is. And we're seeing dramatic contraction in banks, both in the small business lending as well as the even more so on the commercial real estate side. And finally, just Jeremy, I'll just add, well, the ReadyCap is externally managed by Waterfall Asset Management, a alternative, one of the largest structured credit managers in the globally. And they provide services to buy distressed loans from banks, which we did post the GFC. So as Jeremy said, we do, I remember starting my career with the Resolution Trust Corporation. You probably may have read that in a textbook, but you know, we lived it. So, So anyways, we see opportunities there along the lines of what's going on with the banks contracting and starting to sell portfolios as well.
Very interesting. I mean, I just pulled up a screen on Coifin, one of the tools I use, and it looks like maybe 23% of, I don't know if that number sounds exactly right, but of the market cap might be owned by other ETFs, or the mortgage REIT ETF seems to be one of them. We own Ready Capital in one of our ETFs. It's a what we call an alternative income fund. We had Chris Aceto from GapsDAO on our program earlier this year, and he talked about the sort of double-digit yields you can get in this space, and certainly Ready Capital is one of those that we also own in one of our ETFs there on that. In terms of the you talked a few different things, and maybe there's some terms that people who aren't familiar with this space would get some benefit from. When you talk about the bridge financing that you're providing, sort of talk through a normal transaction where you're providing a loan. What is it? What's the timeline that you held it, that they need to use it as a bridge to get other financing? What does a typical cycle look like for you guys and for the people who are taking the loans?
Yeah, Jeremy, that's a good question, because one thing that's unique about ReadyCap is we provide full life cycle financing to usually our sponsors or our borrowers are local operators that are mom and pop that have a track record. They may be a family hit multi-generational investment in local markets. And we rank the U.S. based on a quantitative model 1 to 5 for the best markets for multifamily. Based on net absorption, demographic input. So a simple example would be you might be in the suburbs of Charlotte and you see a Garden B multifamily property, let's say where the rent is maybe, $1,800 a month, but the property was built in the 70s. It needs a lot of deferred maintenance and work. So you may have 10 properties in the suburbs of Charlotte, and you see an opportunity to buy this, let's say for $10 million, and then put $3 million of CapEx into it. So about 30%. So your basis would be $13 million. So we'll provide a bridge to purchase the property and the CapEx. We'll provide 70% financing. So you'd have to put up, let's say, $4 million, and we'd finance the other the balance of the loan for $9 million, for a total of $13 million. So then what happens is you expend that cap. It's a floating rate loan, and it usually is a 2-year loan with one year renewals. And then what you do is you step in and you systematically rehabilitate these apartments, improve the maybe you add some amenities, you basically upgrade it so it's a A minus, not a B minus, but an A minus. And again, we focus on affordable, more of the middle America, middle income individual. So let's say it's now a year from now, you complete what we call your business plan, and now you're able to start releasing the property at not $1,800, but let's say $2,200. So now and once you've released the property and you've stabilized it such that, in the current market for a stabilized multifamily, we'd be looking at it's called the capitalization rate, the ratio of the net operating income divided by the value. So let's say in the current market, you're looking for 5.5, 5.75. So once the net operating income achieves that level, then Fannie Mae or Freddie Mac would make a 10-year fully amortizing loan for that property, which takes us out. So you might now qualify for a Fannie Mae loan, let's say in this example, I would remember is now your fully invested amount is the equity of $4 million and the $9 million loan. So Fannie Freddie will come in and make, let's say, a $15 million loan, and you reduce your down payment by they'll finance it 80%. Debt service coverage they're looking for is 1.25 times. So that's kind of the virtuous cycle of what we do in terms of providing capital to middle America, mostly suburban areas, nothing in the big cities, for the recycling of multifamily properties, usually in strong growth markets. But yeah, that's kind of what our business model is.
Maybe a quick comment. What's an example of the top one rated areas in the five? It sounds like the big cities are more of a challenge. Or what are some examples of top and bottom cities?
It's interesting. The cities, we don't really focus as much in cities because there you're talking about apartment buildings that, they're north of $100 million, right? But we might be, we tend to focus in the suburbs of some of the major cities. So some of the markets, the markets that are not doing well right now, even in suburban for multifamily, are markets where there was a lot of multifamily starts were just crushing home starts since COVID. Part of it is that migration that's occurred during COVID. So, we're seeing now supply hitting those markets, mostly in the Sun Belt. So we don't like the suburbs of Atlanta and areas there. Areas we do like are kind of boring markets like suburbs of Chicago, suburbs of Charlotte. Austin had a little, and obviously San Francisco had some overbuilding. So the smaller satellite markets around there we've avoided. But it's really Rochester, New York is a great market. The northern New York has a lot of great areas where there's in migration of population and there wasn't much inventory. So, post COVID multifamily rents, they were rising on average at CAGRs of, call it 15 to 20%. Now they've rapidly decelerated to equal inflation, which is, call it 3. But in these markets I'm talking about, we're seeing because of supply hitting, we're starting to see high single digit declines in rent. And we think we're right in the middle of that cycle right now, which will work its way through into the first quarter of 25.
It was interesting to hear about the floating rate feature of some of that bridge financing. So that, when you think about what this Fed has done to policies and you mentioned sort of the hard landing in some of these segments, how are you seeing the interest rates impact the overall deal flow? What your the overall prospects for putting out loans and what you're seeing from borrowers? How are interest rates impacting you overall?
Well, the rapidity of the velocity of the increase in short rates, SOFR, had a big impact on our market and the more broadly the commercial real estate market. So just to focus on multifamily for a second, you know, the elephant in the room being office, of which we only have 5% exposure, thankfully. But what happens with some of these borrowers is there's three negative effects from the Fed's, because that's what the Fed does. Their macroeconomic negative multiplier, Mr. Jeremy is here to correct us, but basically what it does is it crushes housing, because that's highly levered to the 10-year treasury, and it crushes real estate, both of which were very levered. Housing, because of the lack of inventory, despite the gapping out in affordability to the highest in 40 years, in 40 years, the home is the least affordable. And I started my career on Wall Street when, you know, there was a mortgage rates were 15-16%, and it's even worse now in terms of affordability. But the demand destruction hasn't happened there. In commercial real estate, and just let's focus on one of our borrowers, what's happened is their cost of financing went from around 4% to around 8%. Okay, so they had a doubling in the interest costs. And some of them bought caps, which are running off now, interest rate caps. So now they're getting a shock in their debt service coverage. That's one. Then the second thing is they have a margin squeeze because the rent growth has decelerated very dramatically, again, from 15, 20 down to single digits or negative in certain markets. And back to the Fed, the cost of property taxes, labor, all of your operating expenses are up around, I was just looking at an index from a company called Diplomat Capital. It's up 6% year over year. So that has created a situation where they've gone, the debt service coverage during this transitional period on many loans has gone negative to below one. So the sponsors have to come up with money out of pocket to keep the loan going and the project going, but many of them are defaulting. And so that's been it's not as much of an issue for us because we are in, on our originated portfolio, our delinquency rate 60-day plus is around 5%. The industry is more like double digits because we focus on smaller sponsors that ironically have more liquidity than the big guys in the central business districts. So, but that's to answer your question, that's created an impact on these bridge loans, and therefore multifamily prices, looking at various indices, they're down since the peak in early 22 when the Fed increased rates. They're down by about 17%. We think we have another 5 points to go.
There's a lot to unpack there. There's so many different areas between the housing markets, yeah. these different places. So the 5% delinquency, like the industry is double that. Where, as you see this cycle, like how long do you think it takes for this cycle to play out? I mean, there's going to be how quickly does the Fed cut? People are now pushing back when the Fed starts cutting. But how long do you think before more delinquency starts showing up? Where do you think that you guys seem like you're in a better position at half the rate, but where do you think the industry gets to at the end of this cycle and how that impacts you guys?
Yeah, I guess, and I'll keep it short and sweet, but there's 8 different answers to that based on 8 food groups in the commercial real estate space. But the multifamily and office are about 50% of all commercial, it's about $54 trillion of commercial, of the value of commercial properties $24 trillion. There's about $5 trillion of debt against that. So office and multifamily are almost half of the total space. So just to focus on those two, we think the peak deliveries have hit in terms of the supply coming on the market. There's very new construction has dropped off dramatically in the last 2 quarters. So we see the market bottoming this summer and with a recovery beginning in the first quarter, second quarter of next year I'd say multifamily, industrial is hanging in there. Hotels surprisingly have done really well with return to, what is that, revenge travel? I think the elephant in the room is office. That's basically not going to bottom until about 3 to 4 years from now.
Yeah, that's interesting. So the work from home environment is part of that, and are there other things? Is that the real story? Like, people, are you just using less real estate, or they're using different types of real estate? Is the main pressure for all that office, or they financed it at sort of sub cap rates where now the borrowing costs have just gone up way too much and they get refinancing, it makes it much harder.
Yeah, I mean, one statistic to look at is the percentage of loans in commercial mortgage-backed securities and banks that refinance. Multifamily is running at around 70% in the current quarter. Office is only 35%. And most of that, believe it or not, suburban is killing it, and central business is hurting. Yeah, I mean, a lot of basically, if you look at the causes of what's occurring in the decline in the net operating income of these office properties, I say 2/3 of it is due to the work from home trend, because on average, when people release or renew a lease, they're cutting their space by, on average, about 25-30%.
Interesting. Yeah, we moved ourselves, anecdotally, we moved from a big floor on Park Avenue to an industrious space at One Penn Plaza, and we're definitely shrunk our footprint like 2/3. You know, we did a bit more aggressive cut down, and then we found it worked. But you know, it's an interesting dynamic of how people are managing space differently in post-pandemic world.
Yeah, we see concepts like desking. You know, you come in Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I come in the other 2 days. We share the same desk.
Yep. Yeah, we're seeing some of that too.
That's what you see that with a lot of our. That's why we were very bearish on office even before COVID. And as a result, only 5% of our $11 billion portfolio is in that space. But it's about, I'd say it's about 17% delinquent.
And for your own portfolio, is it concentrated in sort of the big cities? Is it in the suburbs like the other multifamily stuff?
Well, again, we focus on 5 to 50 million. So there's very few, if you look at those oligarch towers on Central Park and
a little bit more than 5 million.
Yeah, they'll be a little bit more. That's one unit and those things is not equal to one of our units. Almost, I'd say, in 85-90% of our portfolio is outside of CBDs, central business districts.
Very interesting.
Our average loan size is only about 12, 13 million.
Maybe you could talk through what you see as the valuation story for commercial mortgage REITs and sort of the discounts that people are seeing versus book value.
Yeah, so if you look at the commercial mortgage REIT space going back to just before the GFC, great financial crisis, it typically on average trades at a slight premium to book. And that's because the dividend yields are consistently in high single digits, call it 8-9%, and has a very strong retail base. When you hit a credit cycle like we're in right now, and as we talked before about one of the few areas where we're in a true recession is commercial real estate, with an emphasis on office being about over half that the decline in property values and what have you. At this stage in the cycle, the velocity of the rate increase has impacted the industry in two ways. One is obviously defaults, in particular on, I'd say about 80% of the loans in the commercial mortgage REIT space are these transitional or bridge loans where, you know, the sponsor or the developer will acquire a property, rehabilitate it, and then increase the rents and then get a permanent loan from a bank or the government agencies in the case of multifamily. But what's happened now is, as we discussed earlier, rates have shocked the cost of capital for these transitional loans. They're getting a margin squeeze on their decline in rent increases, as well as the cost of operating expenses. And so that's resulted in a increase in the level of non-performing loans. Now that, so I'd say for the multifamily space, it's probably running 60-day plus. It's probably running in the, high single digits, you know, 6, 7, 8, 9%. Some are higher, some are lower. But there's a lot of flexibility to extend and modify the loans because a lot of these multifamily properties there's still a solid demand for apartments versus housing, given the buy versus rent is still at a historic high, given the increase in 30-year fixed rate mortgage rates. So the multifamily is going through a rough patch, but it'll work itself out. It's going to bottom this year. The big thing is office. And so just getting back to your question, Jeremy, the industry now is trading at around 75 cents, 80 cents on the dollar versus book value. And a lot of that has to do with people questioning book value, right? They think that 75, 80 really is book, except they expect a decline of 20% or more in the value of the gap equity in terms of book value per share. And so you have a confluence of two things. One is for certain REITs that are trading that have high office exposure, they're trading as low as 30, 35 cents on the dollar. Hmm. The well-diversified REITs are trading more, you know, like in the 80s of book. And so that with that range, the issue is we think there's going to be a bifurcation once the sector re-rates at the back end of the cycle, starting in the third, fourth quarter of this year, first quarter of this year. REITs with diversified business models and low sector exposure to office, you know, like Ready Capital, will re-rate back to book. You know, we were trading a book before back in 21, early 22. And then the office REITs will continue to languish. And the other issue is, since these stocks are valued not just on book value, but on the dividend, the decline in the increase in non-earning assets has crushed dividend yields as well. A number of office exposed REITs have sequentially increased their dividend. I just saw one last night increase their fourth decline in the last year. So that's really the cycle. And you're going to see a bifurcation, though, when the industry re-rates on the back end of this cycle and delinquencies come down and we flush out the non-performers, that the ability to earn, if you have fresh capital, our ROE right now on our dividend yield that we can get on a levered basis is 15 to 20. Before the Fed increased rates, it was more like 10 to 13. Hmm. So we're at historic, you know, cyclical high. So when the Fed rate cuts kick in and you start to see transaction volume in real estate increase, prices bottom, in all but office, you're going to see a significant re-rating in the group back to that book value plus. And, you know, we think what we try and target in ReadyCap, over the last 7 years, we've produced a average dividend on book value of 10%. And so, you know, recently it declined in the last two quarters to around 8. The reason for that is we did a large M&A transaction in May of last year from a SPAC that went sideways, focused on single family construction and small multifamily assets, not in great markets, not with great borrowers, but we were comfortable acquiring that at a discount. But it de-levered our balance sheet, and we've had some decline in our asset yield from some of our non-performers. That's temporarily resulted in a decline in our dividend yield from that target 10 to 5, I'm sorry, to 8. However, we have a bridge to get back to that 10 plus in the next 2 to 3 quarters by liquidating that the non-performing loans from the acquired REIT, the SPAC, the failed SPAC, and then reinvesting that at that 15 to 20% current returns in our core market to achieve our 10% yield again. And so if we're currently trading at around 65% of book, you know, that 10% yield would increase to 13.5%. And obviously that would cause the stock to re-rate because retail investors are attracted to the dividend. And you mentioned, you know, Chris Aceto is a friend of the firm at Gapstow, and you know, that the Wisdom Tree, I think, is a great, you know, tool for investors to get exposure to this sector as well. But that's, you know, we're relatively bullish on where the cycle bottoming and the re-rating of the REITs, the commercial REIT space, but it will bifurcate between the more multifamily focused versus the office heavy REITs.
That's interesting. So when I look at the traditional dividend yield numbers, so you mentioned the concept of dividends versus book value and trying to get towards that 10% on the stock itself, because it's trading at 65 cents of book value, is it fair to say the yields are around 13%? Is that around the right number on dividends versus market cap, or is that just not a number you focus on as much?
No, we look at both. I'd say the group right now is trading at around a 10.5% yield on book. I'm sorry, on price. And on book, it's declined to around, call it 8.5%. It was, whereas before it was trading more like 9 to 11, and the stock and most of and the sector was at book value. So now what's happened is because of concerns about book value and the sustainability of the dividend, the market is forward looking and it's discounting write-offs of up to 20% on office heavy exposed REITs, continued dividend declines. And so therein lies the opportunity for a smart investor to understand which REITs will are more heavily discounted versus the forward-looking delinquency rates and dividend power. And so that's what my point is, like diversified REITs like ReadyCap that have lower risk multifamily exposure. We have this SBA, Small Business Administration business, which is a real cash cow, has very little capital involved. You know, it's 5% of our equity and 15% of earnings. That provides significant upside and a re-rating of diversified commercial mortgage REITs like ReadyCap versus others that have heavy, 40% plus office exposure, which is going to be a multi-year workout event.
Maybe two things. You mentioned an acquisition, and you guys have a history of doing acquisitions. Where, as you look at the space evolving and mentioned there might be some other distressed places with some of these things trading at 30 cents of book value, do you need to raise capital to do more of these things? How do you think about the opportunities to pick up some cheap assets throughout this cycle coming up?
Yeah, I'd say, we've done, like I said before, 8 M&A transactions in the last decade. And I'd say about 3 or 4 of those were broken toys, subscale REITs they were subscale and they had high non-performing ratios. And one was an activist stepped in and we worked. We're not confrontational. We work on a friendly basis with management. But we have very, very broad asset. The external manager has good asset non-performing loan workout capabilities. So we're able to go in, price the situation, price the risk. And we do these book for book exchanges where we'll adjust your book value for the non-performing assets. And, you do the same for us, but we've been very successful at doing these, merging these REITs, selling off the non-performing assets at a higher basis than the discount that we ascribe to it on the merger date. And so that's been a very accretive way. We've grown from our IPO in 2016 to when we were about $400 million to about almost $3 billion today of common and preferred equity.
Now, you mentioned being this non-bank, sort of one of the largest in this SBA market, and the 5% versus 15% of earnings is a very interesting number. Maybe give us a little bit more details on how that whole part of this SBA business works. Like what's involved in that segment of the business?
Yeah, so I think the easiest way to illustrate it is an example. So let's say you're a doctor and you want to buy your medical office building for, keep it simple, $1 million. So you'll put down 10%, $100,000, and we'll provide you with a fully amortizing 25-year loan at prime plus 1 or 1.5, okay? Which, in today's market, obviously is around high single digits. So what happens is, as soon as we originate that loan, we take 3/4 of it, 75%, and that's packaged in the secondary market into a government guaranteed by the SBA, which is full faith and credit of the U.S. government. And that'll sell for a very low, it trades at a price of 110 in the secondary market. So we make an immediate 10-point profit on that that $750,000retained sold interest. Now we're left with a $250,000 retained interest. We continue to service the loan and work out any defaults. And with that $250,000 retained interest, if the loan goes into default, and I'm married to a breast cancer surgeon, I know they're not doctors and they're not the best business people. So let's say that that practice is mismanaged and the loan goes into default, and it's sold for $900,000, so there's $100,000 loss. The government covers 75% of that, and we take 25%. So it's a pari passu interest. So it's very limited risk to the originator of the loan. And the other factor is we can secure in the asset backed bond market, we can borrow against that 25% retained interest at about 60% advance rate to reduce our basis to only 10%. So it's a very capital light, highly profitable business. And in order to be an SBA lender, you have to be a bank. There's only a little over a dozen non-bank licenses. We're the largest non-bank lender, and most banks treat it as more of a pastime. You know, doing just it's something to get their what's called a Community Reinvestment Act credit. But so we're as a non-bank lender, we're not limited to a small community bank in the suburbs of San Francisco. We can go nationwide, and so it's a unique business model and provides a differentiating revenue stream that's very resilient to a recession. For example, during COVID, our ROE was over 12.5% because we were one of the leading providers of those payment protection plan loans. Hmm. The government in a recession uses the SBA as one of the many levers they press for providing liquidity to the economy. We benefit from that.
Is there anything else you're seeing from the sort of banking fallout? Anything that you see or expect to see from the pressure some of these banks have felt with deposits? Are they changing what they're providing loans to? Are they trying to offload loans? Or just any commentary about what you see? It's interesting that you're seeing this opportunity from the SBA side. But anything else you see at the banks that's really interesting as a macro story?
Yeah, the banks are really our competitor in many ways. They basically exited this bridge lending. And what's very dramatic is they've focused just on the sponsors that will double down on uninsured deposits with that bank. So what they're doing is they're cutting their commercial real estate exposure. I'd say on average from the banks that we talk to, because we partner with them, right? They take us out of our bridge loans in local markets. And so I would say on average with the, there's $4.8 trillion of commercial real estate debt. About 40% of that is with small banks. Under 50 billion. So we expect that to shrink by about 20% over the next 2 years. And so what they're doing is they're basically focusing on the consolidating their relationships with the sponsors that could give them, in their property management business, the escrow, all those aspects, with a big emphasis on deposits. Not surprisingly, from as you mentioned, what happened in the first quarter of last year with SVB, et cetera. But that's one interesting trend. And that benefits us because we don't care about deposits, right? We'll work with a bank to partner with them to provide bridge financing for their customer to enable them to win the permanent loan.
It's tricky for these banks because they're not paying people the 5% they could get in treasuries. And so they're trying to get away with this sort of cheap cost of capital because they don't want to pay people the actual deposit rates. But then, it's fascinating. So when you say that you see the loans declining by 20%, is that just from refinancing that they're not going to be there to refinance, or are they trying to actively dispose of these loans, selling them to other people?
I would say most of them are, what's interesting now, there's not the volume of sales that we saw post GFC. After the GFC, we bought about $5-6 billion of loans from small bank and community and regional banks, at significant discounts, earned, over 20% return unlevered. This time it's very different. They tend to be well capitalized. So what they're doing is it's shrinkage, not sales. So they're letting the portfolio run off and they're just telling, I just took a call from a borrower earlier today, and he just said, "Look, I just got told by my banker that he's leaving. They're cutting the staff by a third, and they're just running off all but the best relationships. And I didn't have enough deposits, so I'm on the red list." So that's what, so I think it's about 2/3 shrinkage and 1/3 asset sales.
Very interesting. It's fascinating dynamic. So in our closing few minutes, are there other features about the Ready Capital story that you think people don't fully appreciate about the opportunity, or things as you think about navigating through this whole cycle of this moment?
Yeah, I think we have a diversified business model. We're in multifamily, low middle market multifamily, which is where price declines are maybe going to be peak to trough, more like 15%, not the 25% you're seeing in large multifamily developments in central cities where there's a lot of negative absorption, meaning too much supply versus demand. So our credit metrics are where we're trading reflects kind of a baby with the bathwater discount. And then the other aspect is our dividend is temporarily suppressed due to this delevering from that M&A transaction last year, which we have a pathway to liquidate those assets, relever that equity, and reinstate our 10% dividend yield in the back half of this year.
And trading at 65 cents a book value. So you got that, that brings you back up to very, very interesting. Where, if people want to learn more, where can they find more about Ready Capital?
Our website's pretty descriptive, and gives you the various, breaks the business down into the two segments, the commercial real estate lending and the SBA. And if you got a friend that wants to open a pizza shop or wants to buy an apartment building, we're your one-stop shop.
Well, this has been a fun conversation. This is a very important space, very critical to all the macro stories. So I appreciate you coming on Behind the Markets to tell us your story and give us share some lessons about what you're saying. Thank you so much, Tom Capasse from CEO, CIO of Ready Capital. I'm Jeremy Schwartz. You can listen to us on our Behind the Markets podcast. Chris in the studio, thanks for helping us today. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Thanks for listening to the Behind the Markets podcast. If you want to learn more about WisdomTree, visit wisdomtree.com. You can also follow me on Twitter at Jeremy D. Schwartz. I'd like to thank Patty Hall for producing our live program on SiriusXM Channel 132 and our podcast producer, Daniel Bruno. Join us next week for another edition of the show.
For more insight from Business Radio, please visit businessradio.wharton.upenn.edu.